This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. In recent days, Lionel Shriver has been in trouble. Her criticism of the publishing industry's diversity drive has led to her being marked as a racist and even dropped from a literary judging panel. She argued that ethnic quotas harm rather than help diversity. So is she wrong? I talked to Coleman Hughes, Lionel herself, and Ash Sarkar.
I'm not in opposition to diversity, which of course these days is tantamount to being against world peace. But it's just a question of how we get there and how quickly. And I don't think that using a quota system is the best way to go about it.
As Robert Mueller's investigation continues, several dodgy links to Britain have surfaced that could bring down Trump.
But there are many other aspects to this. Steele getting Sir Andrew Wood, former British ambassador in Moscow, to put this document into the hands of Senator John McCain, and then that being handed on to Comey. Sir Richard Dearler, former chief of MI6, being consulted by a rather desperate Steele about what to do and being told, yes, the Americans have to know this. Credible reports we have of the head of GCHQ going to hand intercepts to the head of the CIA, and so on and so on and so on.
And finally, in the age of Me Too, is sex becoming more sexy again, precisely because of social repression?
Yeah. I mean, authoritarianism is sexy, right? Like, of course, that's hot. But, like, the Me Too isn't that. Like,
can we go into that a little bit, Kate?
I mean, that's what you're arguing in your piece, right, Cosmo?
So first up, do quotas help or hinder racial equality? That's a big question we've been asking at The Spectator recently. Since we published Lionel Shriver's critique of Penguin Random House's diversity drive, she has been labelled a racist and even dropped from a literary panel. But Coleman Hughes says in this week's cover piece, not only is positive discrimination racist, it also doesn't work. And he points to evidence from the United States. Coleman will join me shortly, but first up, Lionel Shriver to explain her article to those who may not have read it or have misunderstood it, followed by Coleman and then Navara Media's Ash Sarkar. So Lionel, you've received a lot of flack in recent days for what you've said about Penguin's diversity drive. For listeners who aren't caught up or a bit confused, can you just give us a brief summary of what you actually said?
Well, essentially I was just suggesting that publishing companies not resort to hard and fast numerical quotas in staffing and especially their authors lists in order to diversify. I'm not in opposition to diversity, which of course these days is tantamount to being against world peace, but it's just a question of how we get there and how quickly. And I don't think that using a quota system is the best way to go about it. And this has been widely misinterpreted. I think willfully misinterpreted, because we're living in a world where people thrive on having enemies. And I seem to be filling a need. But what I was saying initially with, I think, a sense of humor, which is always dangerous, was actually quite moderate. And there would be plenty of American liberals who would agree with me. The United States has had 50 years worth of experience of affirmative action, and I'm afraid the results, while difficult to weigh, on balance, at least in my view, suggest that they do more harm than good. And I support somewhat gentler, more incremental approaches to increase diversity. I think that ends up being more successful in the long run. And ironically, one of the things that I was misinterpreted over was as attacking a program called Right Now, that's Right Now with a W, that Penguin Random House runs, which is an outreach program to minority authors, young people who are just starting out, puts them in touch with more established authors and tries to cultivate their talent. And the irony there is that I think that's exactly the kind of program that is great and I support. I think that's when I was talking about softer, less numerical approaches to this problem, then that's exactly what I was talking about.
Have you had people getting in touch with you privately to say, oh, I'm not going to say this publicly, but I really agree with you and I'm sorry you've been getting flack, but I don't want to get the flack, so I'm not going to say anything?
Well, they don't admit up front that they're not going to say anything in public, but they just, they pretty much don't. I have been contacted by huge numbers of people who agree with that column and think that I have been unjustly persecuted. In fact, that's mostly how I know about having been persecuted, because I'm not on Twitter and I don't read any of this stuff. So I've only had to infer it from the number of people who get in touch with me and ask me if, quote, I'm okay. So yeah, I am okay. But I don't sense there are a lot of people out there who are sticking up for me.
You've been removed from a judging panel as well. Was that something that was done in any consultation with you, or were you just told that you were being removed just like that?
Oh yes, it was just announced to me. Not, look, the irony of that one is that, I mean, first off, I had forgotten all about the fact that I agreed to judge this minor short story contest, and I was glad to get out of it. I mean, it was just, I was doing Ms. Lexia a favor. They implored me to be their short story judge, and then suddenly they don't want me to do it. Well, fine, I'm off the hook. So it's not really breaking my heart.
With hindsight, would you have written your column differently? You've already talked slightly regretfully about using humour, but can you see any points in the criticism?
I don't mean to say I regret using humour, and I will continue to do so, even though it may not always please a certain audience. The truth is, there's a certain audience out there that I'm never going to please, so I might as well write whatever I like. Well, there's one line in my original column that has been widely misinterpreted because it's been taken out of context. I don't know whether I would write that any differently today.
So the sentence that you used was, we can safely infer from that email that if an agent submits a manuscript written by a gay transgender Caribbean who dropped out of school at 7 and powers around town on a mobility scooter, it will be published, whether or not said manuscript is an incoherent, tedious, meandering and insensible pile of mixed paper recycling. So you are suggesting, though, that below par writing is being published as a result of these diversity drives.
Well, I'm not saying that this is happening, but I'm saying that the rigid enforcement of quotas would naturally tempt an editor to go for a manuscript that maybe wasn't all that great. I mean, that line was written with exaggeration, obviously, because it ticked the boxes.
Thanks, Lionel. And now on to Coleman to discuss his magazine piece this week. So, Coleman, you say in your piece that Britain seems to be following America down a dangerous path. Can you tell us about the impact of affirmative action in America?
The impact of affirmative action in the U.S., it has not been clear at all. Its proponents want us to believe that it's been all perfect, but there's evidence that when you put black kids who are underprepared in a school that they wouldn't have gotten into based on test scores alone, they end up not doing as well. For obvious reasons. I mean, it's so obvious. It's the objection that you would make thinking about the policy for about 5 seconds. And we have data to support this. In the 90s, the state of California gutted affirmative action overnight. And at UC San Diego, the GPA gap between black and white freshmen completely disappeared. That's exactly what you would predict would happen if you think test scores matter, if you think test scores are indicative of preparedness level, and if you think that matters.
It's interesting that you refer to preparedness, because it sounds as though these students could still have been admitted with a great deal of merit, but just haven't had the coaching, I suppose, that some of their white peers may have had. So is it a case actually of colleges being able to get those students up to speed so that they have the same advantages once they're there as their white co-students?
That is the theory that has been used to support affirmative action. The idea is that the SAT, which is one of the two big tests here to get into college, it underpredicts black success at these schools. So a black kid that, you know, tests at a level that will get him into some school, he'll actually end up doing better than the test will predict because he didn't get the test prep that the white students and the Asian students got. That's almost certainly true for some black kids, but the data on the whole show that actually the tests tend to overpredict success or predict it quite well.
You also mentioned the possibility that Harvard has been consistently rating Asian American applicants low on personality traits such as courage and kindness. Just explain the implications of Harvard doing that.
First, what happened is that there was an internal report that Harvard conducted within itself 5 years ago that found that if they only admitted applicants based on test scores alone, the number of Asians would go from 19% to 43%. Obviously, they did not want that to come out because it just shows the scale at which they're discriminating against Asians. And now, just 2 or 3 days ago, we found out a document was unearthed in the recent lawsuit that Harvard fought furiously to keep hidden, which was data showing that they would use all these subjective personality measures on a college application in addition to test scores. They have subjective personality measures like courage and kindness and likability, and they were systematically rating Asians the lowest of any ethnic group on these measures, and they could factor that into the application, and that way they could keep the numbers of Asians down while still having a sort of appearance of fairness.
Firstly, why would they want to discriminate against Asian American applicants quite so heavily?
Some people think that non-Asians don't like applying to schools where there are too many Asians. That's one theory. There's probably some truth to that, but I think the bigger truth is that these college presidents and college administrators are in a very tough position because if they get rid of racial preferences, they will be absolutely pilloried as racists by many black intellectuals and black activists and black politicians. There are very few Asian politicians with power in this country. There is not a huge contingent of Asian American activists and Asian American intellectuals who make noise on these kinds of social justice advocacy topics, but there's a huge machine of advocacy coming out of the black community. So if they get rid of racial preferences, which would be what it took essentially to be fair to Asians, it would be an absolute press nightmare for these people. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place where they have to continue discriminating against Asians as long as they can. And if they stop, then they're going to get completely pilloried on the other side for what will be seen by many black intellectuals as gutting a program that is essential to black success.
So finally, what's your solution to this? What would be a better way of doing university admissions? Do you just see it as being something that has to be taken blind and on merit?
I think eventually, yes. I think it's just going to become intolerable. I mean, like I said, there's an Asian American called something like the Students for Fairness. It's an Asian American group suing Harvard, and they have a very solid case. And when it comes down to it, people really, really want to be treated fairly. And that was, in fact, the logic behind dismantling Jim Crow in the first place. It's that people have an innate desire for fairness, and we've decided in our political system that we're going to cater to that desire for fairness. People do not want to be treated differently because of the race that they were accidentally born into. And that principle probably has to prevail in the end.
Thank you, Coleman. And one writer who does disagree with Lionel and Coleman is Ash Sarkar from Navara Media, and she joins me now. So, Ash, you've read both pieces mm-hmm. by Coleman and Lionel. Surely there is some credit in the arguments that they are posing.
I think the problem with Lionel Shriver's argument is that it's a real mischaracterization of what Penguin Random House have set out to do. What they've said is that it is their goal to have a publishing roster which reflects the society which they find themselves in. And in order to do that, they will be measuring the backgrounds of all the authors that they publish. And this is a change which has, quite frankly, been a long time coming. So in 2015, there was an Arts Council-funded report which said that the publishing industry in particular risks becoming culturally irrelevant if it doesn't become more diverse. And to give you a little snapshot of just how unrepresentative and homogenous the publishing industry is, in 2016, which is, you know, fairly recent, of the thousands of titles published in the UK, fewer than 100 were by authors from a Black and Asian minority ethnic background. So I think the problem with Lionel Shriver is that she doesn't even acknowledge that there is a problem, let alone start thinking about the mechanisms for how you redress that. I think that quotas are an imperfect vehicle, but they get a conversation started about taking an active role in addressing racialized, gendered, and class inequalities in all sorts of institutions in our society, not just cultural ones.
In terms of Coleman's argument, he's looking at affirmative action in universities and specifically discrimination against certain groups such as Asian Americans. Do you think he has more of a point?
So in terms of his point about universities' admissions, and I think that it's important not to collapse or erase the differences between publishing and universities. I think that you have to look at institutionally specific responses. I think that his point about East Asians being marked down lower on things like personality is obviously screamingly, unequivocally racist. But that doesn't mean that we throw the baby out with the bathwater. For me, the issue with the US universities admissions process, which is very, very different from the picture of UK academia, is that one, if you look at the history of affirmative action policies in the US, the greatest beneficiary of those policies hasn't been African Americans or Hispanics. It's actually been white women. And two, what you have in the US and what you don't have in the UK is historically Black colleges and universities. So the story of affirmative action in the US is an attempt to integrate two very separate mechanisms of social reproduction, whereas in the UK we're having to look at the way in which race and class are co-determining. That's also the case in the US, but the difference is that we do not have those bourgeois institutions of social reproduction for people of colour in the UK in the same way.
Do you think that there is a risk that some students may feel as, I mean, I am a privileged white woman, but I have sometimes been made aware that I am on a television panel, for instance, because I am the woman, and everyone else is a man, and they've brought me in because they need a woman's voice. Now, this must be even more painfully obvious sometimes for women of colour. Do you think there is a risk that sometimes students will feel that they're not there on merit, but they have been brought in because of quotas, and therefore they won't feel valued as students?
So here's the thing, is that even without quotas, that's something that's thrown at you all the time. I remember when I was at sixth form and I was choosing universities and I was really, really proud because I'd gotten into Cambridge. I decided that I didn't want to go because clubs were better in London. And one of my stepbrother's friends, she was a white woman, said, "Oh, but you probably got there as a tick box exercise, didn't you?" Just like out of the blue. And Sunday lunch at my mum's house was ruined. And that was really, really hurtful at the time. But it also made me realise that you are going to have your presence questioned regardless of how you got there. And you can have your presence questioned and it still be really difficult for people of colour to make it. Or you can have your presence questioned and there are actually some mechanisms which are constructed in order to facilitate the participation of people of colour in previously racially exclusionary cultural institutions. So I think that that's a price worth paying because the outcome itself is one that's worth pursuing.
Thanks, Ash. Now, these are edited extracts from interviews that we did with all three. And if you want to hear the full interviews in a much longer podcast, look out on our Coffee House Shots channel, where we'll be publishing this podcast very soon.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Now, it seems that all roads lead to Britain, at least in the case of Robert Mueller's special investigation into Trump. Paul Wood, world correspondent for the BBC, reveals the British links to Trump in this week's magazine and asks why, despite all this, the British government has been reluctant to help Mueller. I'm joined by Paul, along with The Spectator's deputy editor, Freddie Gray. So, Freddie, just to start out, could you explain what the Mueller investigation is?
The Mueller investigation is an inquiry into possible collusion between Donald Trump and Russia. And it is as vague or precise as you want to be. And in fact, special prosecutor investigations being what they are, it's become a far more sprawling affair now. And it's looking into all sorts of aspects of the Trump presidency and, in fact, of corruption in American life in general. So it's become a very, very complicated and sprawling thing. But in essence, it's meant to be, did the Trump campaign collude with Russia in order to get elected and in order to destroy Hillary Clinton?
Now, Paul, in your magazine piece this week, you look at the British links with this investigation. Just tell us a little bit about those.
Well, the principal British link is Christopher Steele. He's a former MI6 officer who was commissioned during the election campaign to do political opposition research. Mr. Steele, who's a fairly professional type of person, didn't even know that he was being commissioned by the Democratic Party, but that was who was paying the bills. And what he found, to his surprise, was some quite explosive allegations about Mr. Trump's sex life, about his financial dealings, all of which led Steele to conclude that candidate Trump was vulnerable to blackmail by the Kremlin. And there were a lot of rather strange, in Steele's view, connections and contacts between people in Trump's orbit and Russians. And that is now, as Freddie says, the principal thing being investigated by Robert Mueller. But there are many, many other rather strange British connections. There's a character called George Papadopoulos, who's a young Trump aide who is, if you believe the press reports and Mueller indictment, getting drunk in a Kensington wine bar with the Australian High Commissioner and letting drop the rather interesting claim that the Russians had supplied dirt on Hillary Clinton. This supposedly, or this is the cover story anyway, was what got the US counterintelligence investigation going in the first place, that investigation later morphing into the Mueller inquiry. But there are many other aspects to this. Steele getting Sir Andrew Wood, former British ambassador in Moscow, to put this document into the hands of Senator John McCain, and then that being handed on to Comey. Sir Richard Dearler, former chief of MI6, being consulted by a rather desperate Steele about what to do and being told, yes, the Americans have to know this. Credible reports we have of the head of GCHQ going to hand intercepts to the head of the CIA, and so on and so on and so on.
Freddie, do you think that the British government in particular is playing fair on this?
It's an interesting point that Paul raises in his piece about whether the British, in their eagerness to strike a sort of post-Brexit trade deal with Trump, have slowballed the Mueller investigation on the key British elements. But I just don't know about that. What I do find fascinating is what Paul points out, which is all these amazingly large number of British links in the Mueller investigation and what it says about our country. I think one of the key things it says is that we don't pay our spies enough. So they all have to go into retirement and do this sort of private contractor work. And really, London and former British spies, perhaps riding a little bit off the accent, which still impresses Americans, are basically sort of charging enormous amounts of money to do intelligence spin. And I think that's certainly been the case. And then another element is an even bleaker part, if you like, is that Rob Goldstone, who's a very odd PR publicist, former tabloid journalist, I think, who was connecting the Trump family to a very bizarre Russian oligarch. And so you have this sort of London as this sort of East meets West centre of sort of global intrigue and conspiracy. And it says something odd about the country we are now, I think.
Paul, do you agree with that?
Look, I think part of this is the very close traditional links between US intelligence and British intelligence, who share things at a very high level openly. It's called the Five Eyes Agreement, and countries like Australia are members of that as well. Actually, Steele didn't get paid a king's ransom for this research. I think he was paid $160,000 or so by Fusion GPS, which was commissioned by the Democrats. Not a huge amount of money for something which then might have changed the course of the election and has certainly dominated the political conversation in Washington since. So Steele would say this isn't a matter of money. He wasn't expecting to find the things that he found, was quite shocked by it, and then decided this man cannot be president. He certainly thought that what he'd found could change the outcome of the election and was rather surprised when it didn't. Still could change the outcome of the Trump presidency. We will know perhaps in the next 3 months or so, because apparently President Trump's lawyers have been told by Mueller's team that he's going to report, or at least make an initial report, within 90 days, which of course, crucially, is before the midterm elections. Impeachment is a political process as much as a legal one, and all depends on the outcome of that election, whether we see the Republicans maintaining control of the House or whether we see a Democratic Congress. I think it'll be full speed ahead to impeachment if we do.
Freddie, how likely is it that the Democrats will get into a position where they can
push for this?
I think it's looking less likely as time goes by. I think the Republicans are perhaps too bullish about their chances, but they are looking much stronger in both races, the Senate and House races. And I think, you know, if the Democrats had a majority, they really could push for impeachment. But the problem is that there's a lot of smoke and a lot of sort of suspicious smoke, but there's really not a lot of fire so far in the Mueller investigation. And a lot of people are saying now it might have to be wrapped up quite quickly. I think that's obviously the Team Trump's defence line. And something really explosive could still come. But at the moment, I don't think there's really anything that could hurt Trump, and particularly not if the Democrats don't have a majority. Paul knows more about this, so you could probably say whether that's rubbish or not.
A lot depends on what evidence Mueller actually has, and the investigation is a black box. It hardly leaks. People are speculating. I myself think that there can't have been an actual conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Russians. As one senior aide to Trump told me, we couldn't even coordinate with the Republican Party in Pennsylvania, let alone with the Kremlin. And you look at, for instance, the rather strange meeting arranged between this incredible character, Rob Goldstone, this rather flamboyant British music promoter, who knew Aras Agalarov, this oligarch who supposedly acts for the Kremlin. And he arranged a meeting for Donald Jr. with a Russian lawyer. This was a rather fumbling attempt at bringing two sides together. The Trump side thought they were getting dirt on Hillary. No dirt was produced. Everybody left a little bit unhappy. If there was an actual conspiracy, you wouldn't need a British music promoter to bring everybody together. You would have a very quiet conversation. So I think there was this is how people in the intelligence community have explained it to me. On the one hand, there was President Putin who decided, let's disrupt the American election. Here is a pot of money. Everybody who wants a bit of this money, come to me with good ideas on how to disrupt the American election. Apparently, this is how things are done in the Kremlin. On the other hand, you have people close to Trump who suddenly wake up to the fact that, good Lord, our man's going to be the Republican nominee. What if he actually wins? So there's a kind of gathering rush by both sides to try to capitalize on this situation. Two bunches of, some might say, rather greedy and unscrupulous people colliding with each other in a very chaotic fashion. That is not a conspiracy, but it might rise to the level of collusion or cooperation if Mueller has the evidence. We don't know yet whether he does.
I think also it's worth adding that because Trump isn't going to be impeached doesn't mean the Mueller investigation will not bring down some serious victims. I mean, we had a lot of people talking about Jared Kushner's dodgy involvement. Why did he have his national security clearance revoked? I think that Mueller could bring down a lot of people. I just think there's no sign yet that he could bring down Trump.
Well, let's not forget that President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, is, as we speak, sitting in Club Fed, a federal prison in Virginia outside Washington, D.C. He's there for witness tampering. He hasn't been convicted of anything yet. But think of the enormity of that. The actual campaign manager for the president, the successful victor in the presidential election, is now sitting in jail. Now, President Trump says, quite correctly, that what so far Manafort has been indicted for are money laundering, tax evasion, lobbying, alleged offences, all to do with the period before he joined the campaign. How does this link into any allegation that Mueller may be investigating of so-called collusion with the Russians? Well, the theory advanced by intelligence professionals is that the Russians had something on Manafort. What they had was details of these tens of millions set out in the indictment, which he is accused of not declaring for tax. If that's the case, the Russians would know that. They would have a lever against him, and what they would use that lever to do is to get him into the campaign. He, after all, volunteered his services for nothing. People who know how these political consultants and professionals work know that the campaign is the big bonanza. You get a percentage of the ad buy, you make untold millions, but here was Manafort offering to do it for nothing. The question is why. One answer, according to Trump's enemies and critics, is that he was put in there by the Russians, and that's how these historical offences might intersect with this present-day allegation of collusion.
Thanks, Paul and Freddie. Now, in the wake of the Me Too movement, Netflix has banned its staff members from looking at each other for more than 5 seconds in its anti-sexual harassment training. Ridiculous, perhaps, but could the repression of the Me Too age actually reignite sexual tension? Cosmo Landsman poses that question in this week's issue, and he joins me now with Katie Glass, journalist and writer. So, Cosmo, you seem to be hopeful that one of the great outcomes of Me Too is that you're going to be having more sex.
That's one way of putting it. I think hopefully we will have a time when things are actually more sexy, because the idea that Me Too will kill off all kind of flirtation or sexual interaction between men and women, there might be a degree of repression, but I think repression can lead to greater sexiness. So there's an unintended side effect that we might all welcome.
Katie, firstly, do you agree with the premise that Me Too is killing off flirting and sort of the frisson of sexual encounters?
Yes, I think I do. Although I'm afraid I do completely disagree with Cosmo. And I can explain why. So, I mean, obviously I admire your sex drive, Cosmo. You know, I wish... your spirit. But the thing is, right, you're talking about the kind of freaks you get. You know, the reason people watch porn where it's like the dad and the babysitter. It's like breaking sexual taboos. The problem with Me Too is it's not so clearly defined. It's a kind of grey mess. You know, we don't know what the boundaries are. They're so subjective. They change for each person. So you don't get the thrill of breaking the taboo because who knows what the taboo is.
But the rules and regulations that Me Too want to put in, some Me Too activists want to put in, we know what they are, and that's what's going to change the climate. That's what will people be up against.
But, you know, it started as like very clear boundaries, right, about professional conduct. Right. But then some of it's been about like just snogging someone on a date in an inappropriate way. So for each person, it's subjective. So how do you know if you're breaking?
Well, that's one of the great confusions of our time. The big grey area between consent and coercion is something that's constantly being dated, being discussed and debated. So we don't know. But generally, a lot of commentators have said we're about to enter this new era where Me Too is going to sort of dictate how we conduct ourselves, and it's going to be very bad for sexual relations and those sorts of things.
Cosmo, at the moment, how did you work out whether or not someone wanted your advances?
I think all this has to do with a bit of degree of common sense and a sense of, you know, behaving yourself and notions of civility and trying to be a gentleman and conduct oneself in a way that isn't embarrassing. I think if you're sensitive to the signals, you can tell when a woman's interested in a little harmless flirtation and when she's not. And if you're one of these men who aren't interested in the signals, that's where the sort of the trouble leads.
Well, it was interesting because I'm reading your piece. I mean, I want it to be true, right? I mean, that's great, the idea, you know, there's more kind of sex going because of Me Too. I think actually if there is like some sexual frisson that's thrown up, it's not for you, sorry, Cosmo. It's for women to decide. Like, you know, so
well, that's
actually
my point.
That's
yes, of course.
But that's the sexual double standard. Like you talk about like, yeah, 50 Shades, we've let that. When we see MPs go off and, you know, see some sex worker for some S&M, do we like laugh about that? No, we don't. There's a huge sexual double standard where Me Too is maybe sexually emboldened women, but I think, you know, you're not allowed to get involved.
But has Me Too sexually?
I don't know, hold on, I've got to challenge that. Why am I not allowed to get involved?
Because Me Too, I mean, unfairly, right? As in, I don't think this is okay. But like, there's a huge sexual double standard around Me Too where women's behaviour isn't being policed in the way men's behaviour has been. So sexting, for example, you know, women who might want to send a picture of themselves that's quite sexy, that's fine. If men send a picture, oh, that's Me Too.
Oh, you're referring to it as kind of a double standard.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think it's fair.
Well,
but like,
that may be.
You know?
Do you think, Katie, that that's actually just resetting the balance whereby actually men have had all the power up to this point?
I suppose arguably, but you know, it's difficult, isn't it? Because you're talking sometimes about teenage boys. They haven't had all the power up to this point, have you? I mean, it's a new generation, right? Maybe for Cosmo, it's resetting.
We've lost that power.
Cosmo, would you find it helpful if there were a set of rules, for instance, like the ones that Netflix have been considering introducing, whereby you can't stare at anyone for 5 seconds, which is making me incredibly paranoid in this podcast, because I think you might both think that I fancy you by the end of it.
I don't particularly like those kind of rules, but I think there should be rules and regulations and codes.
Regulations? What sort of?
Well, and the way we behave ourselves. Otherwise, everyone gets completely pissed and we make animals of ourselves and we misbehave. So I believe that, you know, there has to be a kind of civility to our flirtation and sexual advancement, and those sorts of things that govern society are fine. The Netflix kind of rules, don't look at someone, no hugging, no touching, I don't think those are going to work. Imagine how if you look at somebody now for more than 5 seconds, it's going to have a greater impact than the pre-Netflix days.
The pre-Netflix days. Katie, can you see a situation where rules are set out in some way, where there's a sort of millennial version of that old dating book, The Rules?
Well, see, I'm not bothered about rules, and I feel like we had very clear, you know, sexual harassment, it's in law. Like, the problem with Me Too for me is that it hasn't, like, created rules. It's created complete confusion. The Netflix thing you spoke about, you know, in your piece, actually, that's just so confusing to me. You know, how long's not more than 5 seconds? You know, what's a hug?
But yeah, I was also trying to make a wider point, and that is the challenge that the dominant idea that the more liberated we are about our sexuality, the better our sex is. And I was trying to suggest that maybe repression can lead to a kind of erotic enhancement. It can make things more exciting and sexy. And that's something we've sort of forgotten about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, authoritarianism, sexy, right? Like, of course, that's hot. But like, the Me Too isn't that. Like,
can we go into that a little bit, Kate?
I mean, that's what you're arguing in your piece, right, Cosmo?
Well, I don't think I'm saying the unintended side effects that if you have a climate that is more repressive, people find a way around those repressions. People find sort of a way of sneaking through there, and that leads to a kind of a sexy enhancement.
Katie, do you think people are having less sex as a result of Me Too?
Yeah, I think they're having worse sex. Because it's not just that they're having less sex, right? If you're right, if they actually get into bed, it's going to be so prescriptive, isn't it? It's like a driving test. So there's loads of rules.
Please sign
now.
Here to say that this right. is going to be okay.
I mean, do you want that kind of...
Absolutely not, no. That's the great fear. Instead of taking a condom, you've got to take a consent form to bed.
Thank you, Katie and Cosmo. And that's all for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe, rate and review on the iTunes store. We would love to hear from you. And pick up this week's issue to read all the pieces discussed in the podcast, as well as more from Andrew Marr, Ross Clark and Simon Barnes. And we have a special summer offer. Simply go to spectator.co.uk/summer to access 1 month of The Spectator online for free. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.